I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Howell Baum, who's professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland in College Park, who has written a really interesting book about us in this city and about segregation and integration called Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. And Howell, good to meet you and good to have you in the studio.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Very thorough book. Your history is really interesting to me, how you took us back to the 19th century and brought us forward. I think that is an underpinning that's really important that I want to get to in a minute about why you did that. But I think kind of the overarching stuff for me in this book, just in a broad sense, was when you look at the failures of integration that many people talk about today in our world, that you see it as liberals, for one, the way you put it, don't comprehend race. Race is not part of their conversation. So I'd like you to define that for us, but start by defining how this is descended from the Lockean liberal concept and why you think liberals failed to see what they needed to see.
Tell you what, let me start with what the school board did in 1954 as an example of this. So we'll start with a concrete story.
That's fine.
And then we'll take the abstract principles out of the story, and I think that makes it engaging.
Spoken like a true teacher.
Well, what's interesting is that what the school board did is puzzling. Mm-hmm. And so if we think about the puzzle, then thinking about liberalism helps us understand
sure.
the puzzle. And the puzzle is this. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled in May that separate schools are inherently unequal schools. And the Baltimore School Board rushed. Within a week, they met and voted unanimously to end 87 years of school segregation in Baltimore. And then the following week, they adopted the policy that they would implement to desegregate schools. So they acted in good faith. They acted quickly. And yet they chose a policy with two striking characteristics. And this is the puzzling part. One of them was that desegregation or integration would be wholly voluntary. In other words, they adopted a policy of giving parents free choice of which school to send their child
right.
to, which meant that if schools became desegregated, it depended on decisions by black parents and in particular white parents about where they wanted the child to go to school. So the first striking characteristic is they voted to desegregate but made it voluntary. And then the second characteristic has to do with race, which is segregation was a racial policy based on feelings and beliefs about race, and the school board decided to adopt a policy that totally ignored race. And the policy assumed that children had no race and that they had no racial identity which influenced them or anyone in any way. And the policy went like this. The words of it were something like, race shall not be a consideration in where children go to school. And on the face of it, the positive meaning was we will no longer use race to separate black children from white children. But the other part was we will not consider students' race in desegregating. We're not going to pay any attention to students' race in terms of where families choose for their children to go to school. And Superintendent John Fisher said, in fact, we don't prefer any particular racial composition of schools to any other. It's a matter of indifference to us as long as parents have free choice. So you have a policy to desegregate that, one, makes desegregation voluntary, and two, ignores families' race. And to get ahead of the story very quickly, but then let's fill in the details and we'll come back to your original question.
Right.
The results were that the schools were modestly desegregated. They became resegregated in the sense that, for example, historically white schools they went from all white to all black. And white families withdrew from the school system for a variety of reasons, and schools became increasingly segregated. And this can't all be laid to the initial policy, but the policy was the beginning mm-hmm. of this process. So the puzzle is they wanted to desegregate, and the policy didn't seem to be holding to that. It didn't seem to be doing that, and they stuck with the policy. And the last thing I'll say, which is important in the story, is black leaders encouraged the school board to adopt this policy. And that's an important part of the story. When the school board adopted the policy, the NAACP took credit and said, we got the board to adopt this policy. We support it. And black leaders continued to support this policy, the AFRO, the NAACP, for two decades. So it's puzzling as well that blacks wanted to desegregate the schools, and yet, unlike black communities almost anywhere else in the nation, they favored free choice, freedom of choice, as it was called, to do that.
And how do you see that as being, in, from which you're, when you looked at the history of this city? I mean, you seem to write about the history of the city with its huge free black population, the largest in the country before the Civil War.
Right.
And the growth of black institutions in the city and schools and other things, and the development of education in the black world in Baltimore, and how it developed, not as well as whites, but how it developed. There's something in the root of all that that led to this for you.
Well, I think it comes back to something actually you've talked about on your show before, which is whether Baltimore is a northern city or a southern city.
Right.
And the answer is it's both. It's both. A border city in a border state.
Right.
And what's one of the things that's important is it had the largest, as you say, the largest black free population prior to the Civil War. And that was a result of being close to the North and there being space for blacks to be free. And some Marylanders manumitted their slaves and so forth. At the same time, there were slave owners in Maryland. And Maryland, I think what's significant in Baltimore history is there were the forces of both the North and the South coming to a focus here. There were slave-owning interests, and there were abolitionist interests. There was some violence against abolitionists in the history of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And the city fathers worried about what's going to become of our city as the nation is going apart. We don't want the city to fall apart. There are these battles between these interests within our city, politically and socially. And I think what they did was they came to a tacit agreement of let's not talk about race. That's the American tacit agreement, but I think in particular here they said, unless we stop talking about race in public here, we don't know what's going to happen to our city, and we'd rather preserve peace. So that I think that's important. The general position in Baltimore became one you might call laissez-faire on race, which is government would stay out of dealing with race, let people take their positions privately, make their own arrangements privately, whether they were discriminatory arrangements or whether they were tolerant arrangements. But I think the history of the city is government stays out of race relations as much as possible. They may endorse private agreements, but they don't intervene. The government doesn't intervene here to do that. So I think that's an important part of the history of the city.
Do you think that was different than in other parts of the country?
I think there was much more anxiety here because it's a border city about what happens if we talk about race, since there were strong forces on both sides of the issue.
I mean, the way you describe, I mean, the characters in this book come popping out. I mean, it's really very interesting. I mean, when you, in the African-American world, the Murphys and Lily Mae Jackson and the Mitchells and the Marshalls, and I call them the three great M's, the Marshalls, the Mitchells, and the Murphys.
Sure.
But they were pivotal in the battle for equal rights for black folks in Baltimore, and were pivotal in the story about whether it was integrating Polly or the whole question of segregation. They played a major role in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so let's talk a bit about Polly, because that's a very interesting story.
Sure.
Just an aside, James Crockett, who you mentioned in this book, told us a story when he was on the show not long ago, and I asked him about he raised the issue of Polly, and I said, "You mean in 1952?" He said, "No, I mean 1928." And he's told the stories of the those who passed for black, passed for white, who were
right,
black and went to
right,
Polly
right.
In the 1920s. But we're talking about the integration of Polly in 1952, which was a huge thing, and you really kind of build up the momentum in this chapter about how that took place. That's a story from your perspective.
I think what's important about the story is this arose out of an initiative in black organizations. Furman Templeton, who was the director of the Baltimore Urban League, actually I think it had a conversation with people at the Americans for Democratic Action, and someone there said they talked about integration. They were concerned about segregation of schools. Someone there suggested, why not think about integrating Polly? And he was really taken by the idea. So he said, let's think about a campaign to get black boys into the Polly A course. And he was joined shortly after that by the NAACP, and they developed a coalition to do this. And then they started to think about what do they have to do in order to succeed? One, they have to be able to make the legal case that this is something that the school board can make a decision about. Two, they had to recruit boys who, in fact, wanted to apply and had the academic ability, but also the self-confidence and the strength of character to undergo what were going to be stressful conditions at the school. And so on the one hand, there was Marshall Levin, who worked with them, who helped them prepare the legal case, and they did some strategizing. And then a lot of people, including the Mitchells, and I'm told Thurgood Marshall occasionally, a number of others, talked with counselors of black junior high school boys to see who might be worth recommending.
Right.
They would talk with parents. They would encourage the parents. But they'd say, look, these are the risks. You decide if you want to take the risks with your child. There were people who tutored the boys to say, these are the subjects you'll encounter. Let's make sure you're able to deal with them. They said, let's talk about the stresses and decide if you want to deal with them and so forth. So there was all the strategizing, and then they went to the school board and they said, we want to make this application on behalf of these boys. And the school board said, let us talk with the city attorney and think about this, and we'll come for a hearing at the end of the summer, just before school starts in September of 1952. And what's remarkable about this, and it's hard to imagine today, but this was a time when not only were the schools segregated, but the city was segregated. Few white people knew black people,
right,
including few blacks knew whites, including in elite black families. It was a very segregated,
right,
world. Whites were anxious about blacks. They didn't think they understood them, and vice versa. And here is a move to create contact. So the largest meeting of the school board probably up to that time took place. They put chairs out in the hallway. People stood outside. This meeting started, ended up going for 4 hours. It was one of the only times in the history of the schools that people talked about what does separate but equal mean?
Mm-hmm.
What are the limitations of it? What is equal? And the argument by the Urban League was, there's this Poly A course. Nothing could be equal to it. The superintendent went through the motions, or the school board went through the motions of asking the superintendent to quickly put together a possibly equal separate program at Douglas. And so there was the choice. Could this brand new Douglas program that hadn't been started, wasn't funded, be equal to the program at Douglas?
And that was that interesting vote that took place on the school board around that question.
Right.
And the way you build it up, you had the vote. You actually had the vote tally in your book going, vote yes, vote no, vote yes, vote no. Walter Sondheim, his wrestling with how he was going to vote. And it was that's an interesting piece of the story. That sounds like a little drama that took place.
And you can imagine everyone sitting there in this hot room, crowded around, waiting to hear one at a time how each of these people is going to vote.
And it literally happened that way.
And it happened that way.
Right.
And what's impressive is the seriousness with which everyone took this. And Truman Thompson, who was on the school board, said after the Second World War, he couldn't imagine, after whites and blacks had fought together in the Second World War, he couldn't imagine having segregation. And he found it odious. On the other hand, he wasn't sure the law allowed him to vote for ending segregation with regard to the Poly A course. And with the greatest of pain, he voted to assume that this new Douglas course could be equal.
Right.
And the seriousness with which everyone took the vote, I think, was really impressive.
And the vote won, obviously.
It was a 5-3 vote, and Rosalind Thompson, who was the chair of the board and who would vote only if there were a tie, said, I want to go on record as saying I would have voted in favor as well. So essentially it was 6 out of the 9 members of the board.
What's interesting about that also is that this is part of another theme, at least subtext, not, and also part of the text as well, that the problem with some of the liberal philosophy about schools and integrating schools and the life in general when it comes to race is that a lot of it's just wrapped up in procedure. And procedure weighs down the reality of what you have to do.
Yeah, let's come back to your original question, because I think that's a real important issue. Liberalism is a normal American way of thinking. The story we tell ourselves about how the United States came into being is a story, it's our version of the John Locke story, which is people came together, they contracted with one another to create a society and create a government. So that the world starts off with individuals with no relationships to one another, and they decide voluntarily to create a society and create a government. And contemporary liberalism comes from that, and we make three kinds of assumptions, which are along the lines of what you just said. One is the assumption, and this is what's in the minds of school officials in 1954. It's the culturally normal way we think in America. The first assumption is society consists of individuals, doesn't consist of groups. People are not influenced in who they are by groups, but we're essentially all self-made, or our parents help us, but essentially we're self-made. Groups, including races, don't exist. The second kind of thing is just what you said, which is we say, how should we decide things? They say, let's focus on the procedure because we disagree about what are the good things we all want. So rather than trying to impose one single good thing on everyone because people disagree about that, let's focus on a procedure where people get as much freedom to choose for themselves as possible. So we talk about individual rights all the time. Let's give individual rights to choose what they want. And so the procedure is more important than any particular outcome because that we don't agree about. And the last part is we say, let's keep government out of it as much as possible so people have the most freedom to make the choices that matter to them. And I think the school board policy, which I talked about the peculiar qualities of at the beginning, really came from this. The school board looked around and said, let's think of children in the city as just individuals. They're all separate, independent. They don't have a race. Uh-huh. And then they said, and let's think about how we'll decide who's enrolled where. They said, let's give each family the right to choose which school they go to. Let's assume they know it's in their interest. Let's maximize their freedom to decide where to go. And the third thing they said is, government's going to stay out of it. We'll focus on the procedure. We don't desire any particular outcome. We're not going to impose anything on the parents. So I think it was really a straightforward expression of this American way of thinking.
Oh, I'm finished. I'm
and,
sorry.
And race got lost in that picture.
Not only did race get lost, but I think that part of the problem is that people didn't even think about race, didn't think there was a difference, didn't think it made a difference, that black community, because of segregation and slavery and the battle for human rights and their own rights, had a that there was a difference between black and white, other than the fact that some whites might have thought, well, blacks weren't as bright as whites. You know, I mean, that was part of the problem with liberal philosophy, it seemed to me. That was part of what you talk about here.
Well, it's not clear how much people thought about it. I mean, I think two things happen that are related. One is, if you think as a liberal, it's easy not to think about race because race becomes invisible. It's not a perspective that allows you readily to see race. But the second part is, look, if you don't want to think about race, if it makes you personally anxious or if you're concerned about the political conflicts that might arise from dealing with race, this is a convenient way not to think about race. So I think both it makes it hard to see it, but if you don't want to see it, you can be grateful that this gets in the way of thinking about
it. What I kept thinking reading about this thing, though, was these characters. It's like characters in a novel, the folks who
yeah,
Baltimore,
sure.
Which I loved. I mean, I love the way this is put together and the people that made up Baltimore and the battles on all the sides and who they represented, white worlds, Jewish worlds, black worlds. And is that if you look at – if you take the liberal notion of choice that they did when we were desegregating schools and the idea of in your own head – In their own minds, the invisibility of race, other than that, as ending the discrimination of in schools, then comes all the way down to 2010, where we're still kind of want to see the invisibility of race because if it's invisible, you don't have to deal with it.
Right.
And that was the problem in the subtext of what you're talking about here that happened in Baltimore.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the ways of describing what they did, and this isn't fair to them in the sense that this isn't how they thought about it, but in a sense, what they did was to try an experiment, which was to see if you can deal with a racial problem by not talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, no, that's not possible. What the alternative is, how it looks, what it means to talk about race, what about race you should talk about, those are the hard questions we look at. But I think that's one lesson we can take from that. You've got to talk about some things about race because that's what's motivating people's actions.
We're talking with Howell Baum, professor at the University of Maryland College, University of Maryland College Park, who we're talking about his newest book coming out in Cornell Press, Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. Since knowing some of these characters and getting to know Walter Sondheim very well before he passed away.
Sure.
In the last 15, 20 years of his life. And knowing some of the others from childhood, I never thought about it in terms of, well, I did think about it, but not like the way you wrote it, in terms of how, in some ways, liberals and leaders of the city didn't see the forest for the trees, couldn't work their way through it. And there's some stats you have. I want to ask you a question about the sure. lady mean to you. You have stats in Chapter 5. I'm just going to pull it up here in the book so I have it in front of me. Bear with me. About school integration in 1961. And you write about a third of black students attended once white schools. More than half the elementary schools were segregated. Of the 146 elementary schools, 30 were all white and 44 were all black. And only 31 had at least 10% of students from each race. And secondary schools, because they drew from larger areas, were more likely to be mixed. 18 of 51 had at least 10% from each race. That's what you write about. Okay, so you have an era where many of us who lived through that would say, if there was a golden, in our heads, if there was a golden era of integration, it was the mid-60s, early 60s through the early 70s, mm-hmm. And ending then. And we'll talk about that politically, why you think that happened back then from your book. So you look at that, as you write about, it had to do with choice and people being able to send their kids where they wanted to, and white parents not wanting kids with black students, so they didn't send their kids there, but black parents did, and some white parents did, and which my place like City and my school, Garrison Junior High, were integrated where others weren't. But the question I have for you, given those stats and given what you've laid out for us so far, could it have been any different? Given the political situation, could it really have been any different, do you think, in Baltimore the way it was done, the way you look at it?
There's no way to answer that question.
I know, I was just curious.
The couple things I would speculate about. One of the political virtues of freedom of choice or open enrollment is it seems, and I assume this was a consideration of school officials, it seems least likely to arouse white resistance because it doesn't force anyone to do anything. And I think if you go back to 1954 and what was in people's minds, and I think if we want to judge them, we have to try to understand what were people thinking in 1954? What did their world look like? What were the choices they thought they were making? Because we're always smarter 60 years later. We have our own
right.
ignorance
Absolutely.
And our own new mistakes.
Yes, we do.
But,
exactly.
you know, we're real smart about other people's right. mistakes or their shortcomings.
Right.
Several things, and let's come back to your question. One is the world was a very divided world in which whites and blacks didn't know each other personally but had all kinds of assumptions and questions and worries about one another. So here's the school board, and they're trying something no one has ever tried before. There's no recipe book. They're taking a step into the wilderness. They will learn from their experience just as others will learn from their experience. And I think they're concerned about what the white response is going to be. And I just give a couple indications of it. Walter Sondheim, in reflecting on the meeting where the school board voted unanimously to end segregation, says, well, there was this discussion. We asked the city solicitor what the court now allowed us to do. And we talked among ourselves and polled the members and decided what to do and took a vote. And it all took place at different times, he said, in 45 seconds or a minute and a half or 2.5 minutes. And one of the meanings of that short amount of time is people had clear consciences and had no moral hesitation about what they were doing. But I think another meaning is people didn't want to have public discussion of this because they were really worried about what would happen if people start talking about this. What will people say? Can you contain it? What problems is that going to cause? And they really went out of their way not to talk. The school system didn't encourage public discussion about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Walter Sondheim received racist and anti-Semitic letters and phone calls after the school board voted to desegregate. So obviously there were unhappy people. Then someone burned a cross on his lawn. And in later years, he would joke and say, well, it was only a small cross.
Right.
But a cross is still a cross. And he would say, but he would also say he was glad his neighbor Edgar Jones saw the cross and put it out before his children came home and his children saw it. So he understood this. And then when schools opened under desegregation in the fall, there were boycotts and picketing at Southern High School. And students stayed home and parents picketed, and Walter Sondheim didn't know what to expect. And he went down there, as he said, armed with a list of emergency phone numbers, and he didn't know what the emergencies were going to be. And he stood next to Police Commissioner Beverly Ober for protection, and someone threw a tomato at them. And the question was, and I think nobody knew, what was the potential for violence among whites? And I think that was part of their consideration. So free choice worked in the sense that it seemed to alter race relations minimally. And I think that reinforced why they chose the policy. So let's get back to your question of what could they have done differently.
Right.
Well, I think freedom of choice worked in a paradoxical kind of way. On the one hand, it was designed to minimally affect people. On the other hand, it's the policy in a city where whites and blacks are anxious about one another. And the school board says freedom of choice means we are going to have nothing to do with who goes to school where. Our hands are off. No one's in charge. We're not in charge. Now, parents, go. You decide where you want your kids to go to school.
Right.
And I would think about a hypothetical white family who says, we're not all that happy about having our child go to school with black children, but it's the law now. It's the policy. We're willing to give it a try. We want to be sure our child is comfortable and our child does well. We're willing to have our child go to a school with some black children, but not an overwhelming number of black children. Under free choice, there was no certainty any of this could happen. So they might choose a school in April where it looks like the child will get what they want. People make all kinds of choices. Families make all kinds of choices over the summer. They walk in September, and they look around, and their child's the only white child in class, and they feel very uncomfortable and say, this isn't the choice we wanted to make. But that was a fear that people had as a result of free choice, which on the one hand seemed to control very little, but on the other hand really fed people's anxiety and encouraged people to think about withdrawing. So an alternative is to create some certainties, so have the school system and the government absorb some risks for people so they don't feel it's all on their backs. So possible examples. Baltimore City never had school zones. Baltimore City always had this open enrollment. Any white could go to any white school, any black could go to any black school. So there was obviously this crucial change in 1954. But the city might have developed zones in consultation with neighborhood associations saying, we know you're not real fond of this, but can we think about zones that mix white and black children in ways that might work? And take that as an example. That would create two kinds of certainties. One is for this family. One is, yes, your child's going to go to school with some black children, but yes, also your child won't go to school with an overwhelming number of black children. Now, why don't you think about sending your child to school in the city, and let's get on with education. So I think something that created more certainty is certainly.
Because wait a minute, just to an important fact, because the way you just described it, because in that era, African Americans were a large minority in Baltimore, but a minority.
Right.
It was a different way. So when you say, you know, white kids going to school with black kids, and it's literally like at City. Maybe one-third or more. One-third of my class in the city was black, which was roughly the percentage of black folks in Baltimore, maybe a little bit less.
The school system was 60% white in 1954, and in 1960 it became majority black. So
in 1960.
So the school system, there's a higher proportion of blacks in the school system than in the city population as a whole. So that's,
see,
that's
when difference. We talk about integrating systems like Baltimore, I want to come back to some specifics from the book. But when you talk about this and think about it, given the racist nature of American society, I often wonder, and I really thought about it a lot as I was reading your book, whether or not the integration way some of us wanted to see it could actually have happened, because people were going to not do it. I mean, even those people who were, who's like my peers who might have gone to City or Poly or Western or Eastern, the large citywide high schools at the time, they went there in an integrated way. But then whites were in a majority at those schools.
Right.
But then people began from the other schools saying, well, we don't want our kids doing this at all, and started moving out of the city, putting their kids in parochial school, going out of, you know, moving to Baltimore County, whatever they did. So I wonder if this could really, given the climate, ever worked without the draconian methods that people even contemplated in 74 and clearly did in draconian, at least to the white community, in Boston. And without that kind of move, I wonder, given the tenor of the time, if it could actually ever really have worked.
That's a hard question.
It is. But
I think part of – well, the answers depend upon how city officials work with residents of the city. This is not something that – integration is not something that vast majority of whites might have wanted because they had no experience with it. No one had experienced it. So things people aren't familiar with, they're often afraid of. So – asking people, would you like integration, is like asking them about something they don't know about, which evokes their fears, but they can't make a realistic judgment about. So what's real important, what very few cities did, so we can't single out Baltimore for this either, is for school officials and elected officials to talk with residents and say, this is a difficult thing we're trying to do. It's a matter of law. It's a matter of fairness. It's good for children's education. Now, these are all things we take seriously. We know it'll require changes in your lives. We know you're not going to be comfortable with all these changes. But let's try to talk about this. We'll listen to you as well. And let's see if there are ways we can make it work. That's not magic, and it doesn't guarantee you overcome everyone's resistance. But I think what we learned is not trying to have this kind of conversation doesn't work. The other thing I would say is, if you look at the experience with desegregation or integration efforts around the country, places where city officials will say, this is what we want to do, it's going to be hard, but we're in it for the long run, we're not going to backpedal, we will make changes, we'll make adjustments as we go along, but this is our policy. And where it lasts for a while and where integration becomes something people become used to, much more likely to stay in place, much more likely to find parents satisfied, much more likely to work educationally in the sense that children aren't worried about their safety, they're not distracted by tumult around the city and so forth. So there's a variation in experiences.
We're talking to Howell Baum. Howell Baum's book is Brown and Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. And Howell Baum is a professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland College Park. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. We are back with Howell Baum, who's professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland College Park, talking about his book, Brown and Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. There's a period in the book that I found very crucial. I'm curious how you looked at it, because, I mean, I really was hoping to get my mind wrapped around this a different way so I can get some of the names out here, but we haven't done much of that. We'll try to get back to it.
Good.
The names are great. But
good.
The period between 1968 and 1974, between the Black Rebellion and the African-American political war with Spiro Agnew that drove whites to Agnew, who didn't want to be with black people anyway, and then Roland Patterson becoming the first black superintendent, and the 1974 decision. Talk about that period.
Well, I think the meaning of that period is related to the 1960s. It grew out of the 1960s in a couple kinds of ways. In the early 1960s, as civil rights activity increased here in Baltimore, which started in the late 50s and increased around the country, people started to say, with regard to Baltimore schools, you know, they continue to be segregated. There was a group of 28 black and white parents in 1963.
Oh, I love that. That's an important story.
Who said, schools continue to be segregated, and it's not a matter of law, but it's also not an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And the school system engages in a number of practices which restrict black choices and continue to hold the races separate. And one of the practices they were concerned about was locating new schools in all white or all black areas so that the new schools would be probably all white or all black, because people would tend to choose schools near their homes rather than putting the new schools in racially mixed areas.
Right.
And another thing they were concerned about was that, in fact, blacks didn't get free choices. And the free choice transfers didn't work the way they were supposed to work, so that white principals would encourage white parents to transfer their children out of historically white schools as the number of black children increased.
Right.
Or when blacks tried to transfer into white schools, they would either be discouraged from making the transfer request, or the request might get turned down. And many did transfer, but the number who would have moved, in fact, would have been greater because the transfers didn't work as well as they were supposed to. And the parents protested to the school board, and the NAACP got involved, and the school board eased some of its policies and made transfers easier and so forth. And then in the mid-60s, as the civil rights movement heated up, the school board, in fact, hired two integrationist superintendents, Lawrence Paquin and Thomas Sheldon, and they both believed in busing, although they both discovered Baltimoreans didn't believe in busing.
All of us took buses to school.
58% of American children take buses to school today. It's
right.
The question of why you're getting on the bus, where are you going to be at
right.
the other end of the bus?
Right.
Obviously, that's the question. It's not as if buses are harmful conveyances.
Right.
So there was much more interest on the part of the board in looking for alternatives to free choice. And in the 1967 mayoral campaign, Peter Angelos was a candidate for mayor. Tommy D'Alessandro, little Tommy, was a candidate for mayor. Much discussion of what about integrating the schools further? What should we do? There was talk about busing. Is that appropriate? There was even talk about combining city and county schools, which the county wasn't enthusiastic about.
Which may have been the answer, but
I think it would have been worth thinking about.
Right.
But at this point, it's
right
in the distant past. And so Tommy D'Alessandro won. And he won on a campaign that included improving the quality of schools and doing more to integrate the schools. And that was really culmination of a lot of effort and a really bright moment. And he became mayor in January of 1968. And then less than 3 months later, Martin Luther King was killed. And Baltimore, after that, suffered the first riots the city had ever had. And blacks and whites in the city had been proud that the city hadn't had riots. And then at the end of the riots, Governor Spiro Agnew summoned 100 moderate black leaders of his choosing to come to his office in Annapolis. And then he lectured them about how they'd been responsible for the riots and the violence. And as he lectured them, they walked out one by one by one. And then Agnew got hundreds of telegrams from whites who said, you really said what the white man thinks for the first time, and that's good, and you should run for president. And I think those are really important events in influencing both how whites and blacks thought about integration. The whites were frightened by the riots, and they backed off. And I think the blacks were discouraged by not just Agnew's lecture, but the responses of whites to Agnew, and said, okay, this is going to be harder than we thought, and it's going to be painful, and we're not sure it's going to work, so we're not as interested anymore either. And I think that really changed the tenor of thinking among school officials. The school board became, now in 1968, the school board became polarized racially. Four blacks and one white ally comprised essentially a block of five who dominated decisions. They repeatedly voted on issues they defined as racial issues. It was difficult to discuss things because everything was interpreted as a racial issue in which whites and blacks had different interests. The newspapers from the Afro to the Sun characterized school board meetings as a circus. People shouted at one another. People would watch these on television. No one ever watches school board meetings on television, but they found them. They found just the chaos of them something they wanted to watch. and there wasn't much deliberation. And black school board members said, rather than try to desegregate schools anymore, we're interested in trying to control an increasingly black school system. So there was less compromise, less talk about education, and people just really became entrenched. So I think that was the period of rigidifying things.
And it was also a period when, towards the end there, with William Donald Schaefer as mayor, many people argue that was a period when Schaefer said, okay, black folks, you want power? Here, you have the school system. It belongs to you. And people started forgetting about the school system after that, at least in terms of money, prestige, and rebuilding the system, because it became a black system.
Yeah, and the difference, there are several differences between Schaefer and D'Alessandro. One is D'Alessandro was interested in schools. D'Alessandro believed in civil rights issues. They mattered to him very much. I think civil rights issues were less important to Schaefer. He was less interested in racial issues than D'Alessandro. Also, Schaefer's style was much more to let people fight it out with one another, to bargain and to see contests among things and to mediate in the contest rather than to push particular positions too.
There are several critical periods you put out, and this is, I think this is one of the most critical that the legacy of which we live with today. But I want to go backwards again for a moment.
Sure.
Because you talked about the 28.
Yeah.
And this is an important period, it seems, and we can talk about some of the people in it that kind of you can bring them up. Because it was a period when there was an effort between black and white parents and certain people in the black and white community and Jewish community to come together to really make things work. It really worked.
Right.
Americans Democratic Action and Urban League and NAACP and this group was really – talk about that struggle. And that to me was one of the highlights of the moment in terms of cross-racial struggle together.
Well, I know it's really a tangential reference, but in working on the book, I – sat at the library at Morgan and looked through decades of microfilms of the Afro. And it was fascinating. And one of the things that sticks out was Passover recipes in the Afro. And that's a sign, it seems to me, of cordial relations at one point between the black community and the Jewish community. A number of the liberals in the city were Jewish. People in the Americans for Democratic Action, there are people in the Urban League. Some of the participants in the NAACP, some of the members of the NAACP were Jewish. I think that's an important part of the history of this. In the 28 parents, Billy Bramhall was Jewish, and Melvin Sykes, who worked with them, who offered them his pro bono assistance. Also a member of the Jewish community. There was much collaboration. There was a sense of liberalism in the best, most progressive sense of thinking about equality between people. The Jews and the blacks worked together on these issues. And the Jews weren't the only liberals, but they were significantly represented in the civil rights movement. So I think the 28 parents is just one example of that. But I think that's you're right, that's an important part of the history.
Because they really did push to make integration real.
I think they're the straightforward kinds of explanations. Jews had experienced discrimination in Baltimore City as elsewhere. They were sympathetic. Their political views also were ones which appreciated the urgency of civil rights claims by the black community as well.
So when we I also think about how you described the legacies between the superintendents and the political officials, and how that, I mean, whether it was D'Alessandro and the decision to integrate and his going, whatever you do, do it so it doesn't affect me badly. This father, D'Alessandro.
Right.
To the roles of McKeldin, mayor, and then governor. I mean, the political back and forth in this between the school board members and the school board superintendents and the politicians was a significant piece of this history.
Yeah, I think the story about Father D'Alessandro is interesting because this was a brand new world being brought to him. In one sense, he was liberal in being a left-leaning mayor and member of Congress. But on the other hand, what was involved in integrating schools was something he had no certainty about, no confidence about. At the time that the school board acted, Walter Sondheim liked to tell the story of the school board was autonomous. We made this decision, and I said, it suddenly occurred to us we hadn't told the mayor what we had done. And Mayor D'Alessandro was, in fact, in the hospital at that point. And so Walter Sondheim goes to the hospital, and he says, I need to tell you what the school board just did. And Mayor D'Alessandro says, I'm not really very sure about this, but the priests tell me it's okay, therefore I'm on board. And I think he was of the old school, and by the time we got to his son, Mayor, 20 years later, or 15 years later, the world had changed very much with Theodore McKeldin in the middle. And McKeldin is mayor. We're heading back before Mayor D'Alessandro in 1943 at appointed the first modern black school board member. And McKeldin, as governor in 1954, supported the Supreme Court decision and supported desegregation of Baltimore schools. And then as mayor again in the 1960s, was supportive of integrative efforts, and he reassured whites that things would be okay and so forth. So I think he's real important, and Tommy Jr.,
yes.
Young Tommy is really important as mayors who took all of this very seriously, and they made a difference. I think you're right about that.
I'd like to kind of bring us to a point where you conclude at the end of the book, and I didn't get to talk. Let me conclude this way. I'd actually tie some two things together here.
Please.
You spent a lot. You did a lot of reading again of Gunnar Myrdal,
mm-hmm.
in putting this book together, and I'd like you to just as we close out here, take us from the root of Gunnar Myrdal for a moment. You close with the last part of your book talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, and he said the problem of the color line would be the problem of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not easy to do, but I'd like you to tie those ends together for us and talk about what this history means for where we are now.
Let's give it a try. In 1944, the Carnegie Corporation, or in the early 1940s, the Carnegie Corporation said, we seem to have a problem with race in the United States. We'd like to understand it better.
Right.
So they turned to Gunnar Myrdal, who was an economist in Sweden, and said, we'd like to commission you to do a study of American race relations. And Myrdal came here, and he produced two volumes that are 1,000 pages long with 500 pages of notes, and remarkably thoughtful, and he had all the insights that a foreigner can have about another country. And he said, there seems to be an American dilemma about race. And the American dilemma is, on the one hand, people espouse an American creed of equality. On the other hand, whites seem to treat blacks poorly. How to reconcile these two things? And he talked a lot about white psychological needs to see themselves as better than blacks and so forth. But it seems to me what he's also talking about is the dilemma of liberalism. And on the one hand, liberalism is about the equality of individuals. That's the American creed. On the other hand, liberalism says all individuals should be free to think and feel, to think and act as they want. And turns out a number of whites didn't think so highly of blacks and felt it was reasonable to mistreat blacks. So on the one hand, you have equality. On the other hand, you have this emphasis on individual liberty that then authorizes whites in this tradition of individual freedom to act in ways that were not good. Myrdal was confident that if only people had enough education and if only public leaders educated people enough, then they might change. But the dilemma, I think, which he really did recognize was whites have psychological interests in seeing themselves as better than blacks, and they'd have to give that up in order to live by
right.
the American creed. And I think when W.E.B. Du Bois says, yes, the question of the color line is going to be the issue of the 20th, and if he were still here, and he'd be very old, but he would say the 21st century, is related to this. Whites need to come to terms with what they imagine about blacks, what in fact is realistic, what's not realistic, and then give up the benefits of imagining certain things and get the gains of living with real people in very complex, rich kinds of relationships.
So this, you really put together a very important history, I think.
Thank you.
That speaks not just to Baltimore, but to the nation.
I appreciate you saying that.
I really enjoyed wrestling with this book and look forward to doing a little bit more with you. Maybe I have some ideas. We'll talk about that another time, though.
That would be good.
We're talking with Hal S. Baum, professor at the University of Maryland, College Park. Wrote the book is Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. And knowing our audience and all of you, that this is a book that you'll want to read and really think about, and we can come back to talk about it again. And thank you so much. Good to meet you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hal. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.